Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right. We're back again. It's me. It's Cam. And sitting across from me, as always, the man, the king of the paper airplane, Kyle Filio-Filson.
How's it going, folks? I'm nice and cool now, finally. Thank God. After roasting all weekend in a lengthy baseball tournament, the season is over, at least for a couple of weeks. Yeah, we played all day. We had three games on Saturday, and man, they were hot. We had another one on Sunday. Yeah. And we lost to another town, Southlake, and because of that, we were eliminated, which I was kind of okay with.
Fingers crossed, ready
to come
home.
Because I was like, man, I do not want to spend another day out here. I mean, first of all, where we went, there's this complex has about 12 fields, okay? The fields that we just, luck of the draw, I guess, the fields we were booked on to play all three games were the only set of fields that didn't have any awnings or anything. So literally, we were in direct sunlight for hours. And it was hot on me. I could handle it, but like poor little Luke. I mean, after like 3 hours, he was crying. I mean, he wanted to go home. And I'm like, we can't go home.
Yeah, this is it.
So, I mean, he literally was miserable. But I don't know about sucking up all that vitamin D all day. But later that night when I got home, I had plans of watching the UFC and everything. Mm-mm. I was wiped.
Yeah.
You had a disc golf tournament. You called me. You're like, are we recording tonight? I was like, dude, to be honest, I'm done. I just want to sit in here in the AC.
I was like, thank goodness, man. I don't think I can do it.
Sweating and chafing and just miserable.
Yeah, I had a 42-hole round of disc golf tournament, a PDGA-sanctioned tournament that I got talked into going and playing in here close to our house, and it was a bit rough. Yeah, we played 21 holes the first round and then 21 holes the second round in that heat, me carrying around my giant backpack full of discs, and I was trying to do some videoing, and that wasn't working out. Just, dude, I was spent. But I shot not well, but I didn't shoot terrible either. But, dude, I couldn't take it. I think it's the weight of carrying the backpack. I think you ever seen one of those things?
So you're telling me you'd never be a Sherpa?
Yeah, I don't think I could handle being a Sherpa. You know what I'm saying?
Even
yeah.
a just big time backpacker, yeah. Right?
Well, I could handle that. That wouldn't be a problem because I don't think, like a through hike, I plan on doing some through hiking, but you're looking for a light pack. Mine's got discs and bottles of water and video cameras and all that stuff in it. Like my backpack probably weighed between 40 and 50 pounds that I'm lugging around out there by the time I get all my stuff in it. So that's what I said is they make a cart. They have these disc golf carts that you can pull around. Got their built-on little seat. You keep all your stuff in it. And I always said, I'll never have one of those because those are for old men. Old men pull those around. Well, apparently, when I wasn't looking this weekend, I became an old man. So that's when I decided I need to find me one of those carts.
You should just hire, like, from the college nearby, hire, like, pay some girl to carry your stuff for you. And just have her walk around.
Like following some hot chick?
Like a caddy, yeah.
That'd go over real well with my wife. What are you doing? Oh, me and the hot chick is going to go throw disc golf. Right?
Yeah, but that wouldn't work out so well. You were balling out of control.
Dude, I was so spent that day that I'm glad we didn't have any plans. Because, I mean, I really think I got so much sun, I was going to be sick. But I survived.
Made it through it, right?
I survived.
You probably learned something?
Oh, we had a wonderful time. A wonderful time. Made a bunch of new friends. That's what I love the most about the whole thing. But it's funny you bring up caddy. There was a fella there playing, and he was probably a little older than I was. And apparently his college-age son had made a mistake in life, not made the best choices, okay?
Okay.
He was caddying for his father.
Oh, there you go. Hey.
And he was not happy about it.
Probably not.
There was no smile on his face. The dad would throw, and then he would walk a little ways. He'd turn and look, and he goes, come on, boy. And then he would just like, all right, pop. And you just see him. Here he comes down through. The son was, he was doing it, but he didn't seem happy.
I have to ask you something, because I've never been disc golfing before, but this is very common on regular golf courses. Are there like uniforms? Are there like guys that show up to the golf course in super expensive, lavish disc wear, golf wear?
Yes.
And that are terrible?
Yes.
There is? Because I know in regular golf, you'll see a guy to get out, and he's got on a $400 golf shirt, some, you know, pressed pants.
Yes.
And it's 100 out, and you're like, what is this guy? I mean, we're not in the PGA. You don't have to wear slacks, buddy. Yeah. And then he gets out there, and then he just starts shanking them.
Well, I want to say, you know, thanks to Carl and Jason and Chris. And they're probably listening because they found out about the show over the weekend of us discussing. There was another fella I played with, and I hope he doesn't hear this. But yes, he was dressed very well and played very poorly. So I'm not giving out his name. And if you know it's you that you're talking about, I'm sorry, bro, but somebody should have told you.
That's just funny. That
had all
those guys
the fancy
like
shirt and shorts. And I mean, he was dialed in, right? Dialed in. Had all the rule book with him, the whole thing. I'm like, come on, bro, let's just play. But right? we had a great time. Had, like I said, made some really good friends because they break you all up and it's not playing with anybody you know. But yeah, we had a very, very great time. Speaking of great times, I know you folks out there in the UK, y'all like to party it up. I know y'all like to drink a few pints, let your hair down after a football match. I know y'all enjoy these kind of things, right? I mean, everybody kind of enjoys these kind of things. But this just come from thenewscientist.com. This is something I think y'all are going to enjoy. The UK's first public autonomous taxi trial is to begin very soon, folks. Matt Reynolds writes about this, says, step into a taxi in South London later this year, and you might not have to think about paying a tip because the UK's first fully public trial of an autonomous vehicles will soon be underway. For 4 weeks, a fleet of driverless shuttles will ferry up to 5 passengers and a safety warden along a 2-kilometer route to Greenwich. That's his previous trials there and in the town of Milton Keynes require participants to register in advance. Now, this time, the vehicles will pick up anybody wanting a ride, folks. Anybody. Now, the 4-stop route will connect a hotel close to the O2 Arena. That little, of course, I always know it is where the fights are at. And the Millennium Village housing development. So, en route, the shuttle will also call at a river bus stop and a cable car terminal. That says that similar shuttles already in use there at London's Heathrow Airport, but are confined to a purpose-built area off limits to other traffic. But in this Greenwich, the pedestrians and cyclists will be able to access the test route. So it says that the vehicle will lack conventional controls. And then although the wardens will be able to slow them down, it says basically to a crawl or even shut down the autonomous system, but there's little danger of a high-speed collision because these shuttles will be limited to the traveling speed of 15 kilometers per hour. That's it. Now, it does say this. This is a pretty interesting thing here. It says the taxis could carry hundreds of passengers daily during the trial. Now, this is according to Simon Tong at the TRL, a transport consultancy. Now, it's involved in their work. Now, the trial, which was funded by the government there in the UK, is part of a wider gateway project to use Greenwich as a testbed for these driverless vehicles. Now, Zia Wad of the University of Leeds there in the UK thinks that the public transport is the ideal application for driverless vehicles and that autonomous cars can reach places not usually served by buses or trains. That's what he believes, what he says. And that driverless taxis are coming in service elsewhere too. That last September, we talked about it and they bring this up, that Uber was starting to use them in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And then Lyft is also working on them in Boston for later on this year. So
that's cool.
This is going to be very, very. I like the idea of what he's talking about. It's like your trains, you're limited to the tracks. The buses, you're limited to areas the buses can turn around where they can go. But if you have autonomous cars, little shuttles like that, well, then they can go anywhere a car can go. So if you need them to get downtown in an area, like, you know, let's say in downtown Fort Worth or anything like that, maybe it's easier to send these little 5-man or 10-man shuttles down through there. It's way easier for them to move around than it is for a bus to move around or something. So, especially if Uber and Lyft start using them, it's coming. And what's great is I've always wanted to see something like this. You always want to be part, like, man, I remember when all that started. I think that's going to happen for us. I think in our lifetime, we're going to see where it becomes the norm. I mean, we already saw phone, like pay phones, go off the corners where you just don't have them. Everybody has them in their pocket. So I can't wait to see where this ends up.
That's cool, man. And speaking of phones in your pocket, check this out. This was an interesting article posted by Jennifer Langston over at phys.org about how University of Washington researchers have invented a cell phone that requires no batteries. They say it's a major leap forward in moving beyond chargers, cords, and dying phones. Instead, the phones harvest the few microwatts of power it requires from either ambient radio signals or light. The team also made Skype calls using its battery-free phone, demonstrating that the prototype made of commercial, off-the-shelf components can receive and transmit speech and communicate with a base station. Now, the new technology is detailed in a paper published in July 1st episode or edition of, and now I know this is a mouthful. Cam, I know you subscribe to this magazine. You ready?
Yeah, what do we got?
It's called The Proceedings of the Association for Computing Machinery on Interactive Mobile, Wearable, and Ubiquitous Technologies.
Oh, yeah, I helped them come up with that title. Of course.
Now, Shyam Golkota is an associate professor in the Paul G. Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington. And she said that we've built what we believe is the first functioning cell phone that consumes almost zero power. To achieve the really, really low power consumption that you need to run a phone, by harvesting energy from the environment, we had to fundamentally rethink how these devices are even designed. Now, a team of University of Washington computer scientists and electrical engineers eliminated a power-hungry step in most modern cellular transmissions, converting analog signals that convey sound into digital data that a phone can understand. Now, this process consumes so much energy that it's been impossible to design a phone that can rely on ambient power sources. Instead, this battery-free cell phone takes advantage of tiny vibrations in the phone's microphone or speaker that occur when a person is talking into the phone or listening to a call. An antenna connected to those components converts that motion into changes in a standard analog radio signal emitted by a cellular base station. Now, this process essentially encodes speech patterns in reflected radio signals in a way that uses almost no power. Now, to transmit speech, the phone uses vibrations from the device's microphone to encode speech patterns in the reflected signals. To receive speech, it converts encoded radio signals into sound vibrations that are picked up by the phone's speaker. Now, in the prototype device, the user presses a button to switch between these two, you know, modes, either transmitting or listening. Now, Joshua Smith, who's a professor in both the Allen School and the University of Washington's Department for Electrical Engineering, recently said that the cell phone is the device we depend on most today. So if there ever was going to be a device that you want to be able to use without batteries, it's most likely going to be your cell phone. And this proof of concept we've developed is exciting today, and we think it could impact everyday devices in the future. It says next the team is focusing on adding video to the phone. So can you imagine that soon you're going to be able to have a cell phone with access to the internet, and it doesn't even have a battery on the thing. It never runs out. It never shuts off unless you manually turn it off. And you can video chat just like you do. You can FaceTime. You can Skype. Do whatever you want. Stream a video game. Stream a movie. Could use the Wi-Fi, you know, to watch the UFC and airplay it on your TV. And, wow. And it never runs out of power. And this is just the beginning. So, you know, you start thinking about lots of devices like that. Are they going to eventually have, I don't know, cordless drills that never run out of power?
I think it's coming.
Radios, you know, yeah, that you can play on the beach all day and you don't have to worry about it ever running out of power. It's going to have a combination of being able to generate its own electricity from the vibrations as well as solar energy.
Mm-hmm.
Is going to be on everything. I mean, I think
I'm okay with replacing batteries and everything just due to I guess what it does to the environment, the things you have to do to put, you know what I mean?
It's I know.
And because once you use them, then once they're out, you throw them away. I would love to see all the batteries replaced with something like that.
I'd like to see it because Luke likes to eat batteries.
I remember that day.
Yeah.
I definitely remember that day. I got you something here that I think, I know Kyle's going to love this. I think y'all will too. Lon posted this up over the weekend over at Phantoms and Monsters. And we've always talked about, you know, we've been discussing the Mothman sightings in Chicago. But this is something a little more interesting, folks. This is another upright canine encounter. Took place in Bald Eagle State Forest in Pennsylvania. And it happened on the 4th of July of 2017, folks.
Wow. Pennsylvania again. Seems like a lot of dogman sightings come from that state.
Yes. At 11:10, it says a resident of the Wykirk, Pennsylvania area, a friend, were on a designated hiking trail in the Bald Eagle State Park when they heard something walking to their right in the woods, as if following them. Now, they looked on several occasions in that direction, but saw nothing and continued to hear the noise as if something was walking parallel to them. Their first thought was it was a deer, but the substantial noise made them second guess, and, you know, of course, they started thinking, well, maybe it's a bear. The one gentleman was armed with a .40 caliber Glock pistol, so they continued, and they heard a sudden stopping of the noise. Now, they stopped to look around, and there was nothing visible to their right or left. They turned around, and behind them, at approximately 50 yards, stood a large animal that they first thought was a bear standing on its hind legs, but quickly realized it was not a bear. Now, this is what the witness described. A large wolf-like head with short pointed ears, long, muscular, human-like hands, a massive chest, and very thin around the waist. Muscular legs, and from the knees down, what looked like dog's hind legs. Its coat was very short and dark brown. It could have been black, but looked brown. It made no movement toward them, but just kept staring with what is described by the witness as bright yellowish eyes. They started back to the area where they left their car and looking behind them, of course, constantly, but it was not there. But it was following again to their right, and there was noise as before emitting from the woods. Now, they say upon arriving at their vehicle, there it stood in the tree line watching them and stayed there until they left the area. Yeah, it was still in that area. Now, it says the one witness who made the report works for the DCNR and marks out damaged old growth trees to be cut and trees blocking the pathways and the hiking trails and, of course, some of the fire lanes so they can remove them. Now, of course, he doesn't want to be, you know, he wants to remain completely anonymous because of his job, right?
I understand that. Yeah,
and I completely get that. But what it makes me think of is he knows probably what he's looking at in that area or in any area. So when he sees something like that, he's probably spot on.
I don't know if I'd be able to go back to work after seeing something like that, going in the woods and marking trees after you just saw an upright walking canid. I mean, what are you supposed to think of that? I don't know.
I don't have any idea.
Check this out, Cam. This comes from the Telegraph. In a tiny remote Aboriginal community in the outback of Australia, an American linguist just discovered a new language that emerged among the young people in the community and is now spoken by around 350 individuals.
Whoa. A new language?
A new language, all under the age of 35. And they said, you know, how did this new language, there's lots of questions. How did this new language get spawned? Where they're already able to perfectly communicate with each other without it. So what caused them to all of a sudden start speaking a new language? Now, this new language is known as Light Walpiri, and it has 6 vowels and 18 consonants. It refers to the past and present, but does not have a future tense. Now, English grammar sets rules that a sequence of words must be put in for the sentence to make any sense. However, in this new language, Light Walpiri, there is no order in the placement of words. Taken together, these features make it distinct from other related languages and allow it to be classified as its own language, and not just a variation of an existing language. The discovery of the new language was made by an American linguist named Carmel O'Shaughnessy back in 2013. She was working at a small school for Indigenous children in the tiny isolated town of Lajana Manu in the deserts of Australia, and documented her findings in the journal Language. She was particularly interested in how a new language could all of a sudden develop among the younger generation when they were already able to speak their other natural Aboriginal tongue, Walpiri. which has spoken, they say, approximately 5,000 to 6,000 individuals across several settlements and towns in central Australia. They say that this new language is believed to have emerged sometime in the 1970s and 1980s when the children went from switching between English, Creole, and Walpiri to primarily speaking the mixed Light Walpiri language. It says the creation of Light Walpiri is associated, they think, mostly with the place's remoteness. It receives supplies from a truck once a week, and the small town is 350 miles from the nearest city. So that's pretty cool that just in the last 40 years, a new language has started.
That's interesting.
And nobody even knew it, and only 350 people roughly can speak it. And they're all from this one small, tiny town in the middle of the desert, in the middle of the outback of Australia.
It always makes me wonder, the way our language goes now and the way, you know, people misspell things and all that, is how much of our language has changed just since, you know, we've been aware. Like, how many words have been dropped and been added? You know, it's almost like it's a new language as compared to 100 years ago of what we speak now compared to what it was like.
I mean, Ebonics. You speak straight Ebonics all the time, you know? That's a new language.
There's
new words.
There's so much.
Well, you're right. And it's even regional. You know, like if you're up in New Hampshire, say, and you want to make a dish with, you'd say, well, I'm going to make this. I'm going to have potatoes in there. Or if you're down in the South, they'd say, well, I put taters in it. And you're like, what taters? What's a tater? You know what I'm saying? So just regionally, yeah. Names does. For things, the language is different.
It just makes me wonder, you know, like how much has been lost. I mean, it's very interesting.
Very interesting. Also interesting is what I'm going to be talking about on today's show when we get back from the break. I'm going to be talking about a lot of crazy and strange UFO encounters that actually happened during the Vietnam War. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
UFOs have had a long-time relationship with us, and for some reason, they seem quite interested when we humans are at war with one another. UFOs are mentioned throughout the Bible, found in Renaissance art, and on ancient coins, and even in cave paintings. But from early to modern times, UFOs have been particularly conspicuous when the world is involved in armed conflict. The question is, why? Hundreds of UFOs, known as Foo Fighters, were spotted by Allied bomber crews during World War II. The American military claimed they were Nazi superweapons, but once the war was over, this proved untrue. But what were they? During its 30 years at sea, the USS Franklin D. Roosevelt was hunted by numerous UFO sightings. Was this because it was the first American aircraft carrier to carry nuclear weapons? Or was it something else? There were numerous sightings by fighter pilots during the Korean War as well, along with UFOs hovering near or above our intercontinental ballistic missile sites. For whatever reason, they seem very intrigued in our wars. But they don't only watch or spectate. Sometimes, they actually get involved. What most people don't know is that there were more UFO activity during the Vietnam War than any other. In fact, there were numerous bizarre reports of actual confrontations between military forces and other forces not from this world. Starting with sightings and conflicts in the air, apparently a few F-4s, A-6s, and A-7 jets were involved with what seems to be a dogfight with UFOs at Dong Ha Base, whereas Newsweek correspondent Robert Stokes happened to be at the time to witness the entire event. According to Stokes' report, 13 sets of yellowish-white lights appeared over the nearby Ben Hai River, after which jets were sent to intercept. One of the fighter pilots apparently managed to shoot one of the lights out of the sky. Strangely, when the reconnaissance planes were scrambled to investigate, the crash site was only a charred, burned-out spot on the ground, with no discernible wreckage at all. In another strange account, in the early 1970s, an American B-52 bomber went down over Laos under very mysterious circumstances, with some last communications from the downed plane making frantic claims that they were under attack from a UFO, which looked like a large light. A Green Beret captain named William English was reportedly assigned to Special Forces Investigation Team, sent out to go and try to uncover what had happened to the B-52, and they were able to locate the plane in the jungle. Oddly, the craft was found to be fully intact and sitting on the jungle floor as if carefully placed there, with no trail of leveled vegetation to indicate a crashed landing. An inspection of the hull showed no signs of external damage from a crash or any indications of being hit by flak, bullets, or a missile strike. The only damage that could be found was discovered on the bottom of the plane, as if it had been simply dropped there from some height, as if a large crane had lowered the plane into the middle of the jungle and then dropped it when it was 50 feet off the deck. As weird as all this was, things would get stranger still when the cockpit was pried open. The entire crew of the plane was allegedly found still strapped into their seatbelts and had been disfigured and mutilated somehow, although the report is not clear on just what way. Other than this, the rest of the cockpit was completely pristine, undamaged, and in working order. So what happened to the B-52? Indeed, it seems that aircraft during the Vietnam War were often threatened by unidentified flying objects, which seemed to often buzz and almost appear to be toying with the military aircraft. In most cases, these strange objects would be gone before the targeted fighter could even have a chance to respond. A former U.S. intelligence officer based in Vietnam by the name of George Filer has claimed that during his time in the country, he was tasked with dealing with a wide range of such aerial encounters that defied explanation and engagements between military aircraft and UFOs. Filer would say of these incidents, "You'd have an aircraft flying along, doing around 500 knots, and a UFO would come alongside, do some barrel rolls around the aircraft, and then fly off at 3 times the speed of one of the fastest jets we have in the entire Air Force. So, obviously, they have the technology far in advance of anything we have." Unknown objects were often sighted by radar, roaming up and down the coast, and apparently, no one could quite figure out what they were. They appeared on radar to be low, slow-moving objects, just like helicopters. But often, there would be no visible confirmation, or would not look at all like helicopters. They were also prone to just disappearing into thin air, and jets scrambled to intercept the objects would arrive to find nothing there at all. Troops on the ground would sometimes witness the lights appear and disappear out of nowhere. And in one such case, American artillerymen reported seeing a group of mysterious lights along the Benhai River. But when they opened fire on them, the objects had suddenly vanished, as if they had never been there at all. At no point did anyone report seeing an actual helicopter, and the strange objects were always described as moving lights, often hovering erratically or moving in sudden bursts of speeds inconsistent with that of a helicopter. The origin of the strange lights remains unknown to this day. There were theories at the time that somehow a misreading of radar signals had occurred, which had then made other friendly vessels appear to be slow-moving blips, or that the North Vietnamese had more helicopter power than had previously been assumed. In the end, the official explanation was that it was all due to atmospheric disturbances, swamp gas, ball lightning, or possible enemy helicopter activity, coupled with panicked friendly fire. There have also been theories that it was all due to bird flocks or even insect swarms. But does any of this really match what occurred? The strange sightings didn't only take place in the skies above Vietnam. Troops on the ground had some rather strange encounters as well. One particularly bizarre incident occurred in 1970 at Long John Island, where a five-man team of soldiers claimed that they were being hunted by bright lights, measuring a mere 4 inches by 4 inches in size. These lights were described as disc-shaped and having what were called black eyes, and they were said to be capable of great feats of maneuverability, darting, zigzagging, and hovering all over the place. The team claimed that when they fired upon the objects, they would shift color to an angry glowing red, with the black eye part morphing into a bright green. These intimidating and menacing lights apparently stalked and attacked the team during both daylight and nighttime hours over a period of 5 days, often coming shockingly close to within 5 feet of the team's position. One of the men supposedly took several photos of the bizarre incident. When the men got back from their harrowing ordeal and were debriefed, they told of what had happened to them and were reportedly told to forget about it, not to speak of it, pretend it never happened. Their equipment was also searched and some of it confiscated, including the pictures that had been taken. People were brought in to interview them extensively on what they had seen, and although it was unclear who they were, at least one of the men was convinced that they were CIA. Even odder still is that a few months later, some American personnel allegedly showed up at the homes of the soldiers' parents, asking about any photographic materials that may have been sent to them. The whole thing adds the layer of a sinister cover-up to the already rather scary events depicted by the report. Another strange event allegedly occurred on June 15th, 1968, along the Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ, between North and South Vietnam, where a patrol boat known as PCF-12, commanded by Lieutenant Pete Snyder, was on a routine night patrol near Quà Viet at 12:30 a.m. PCF-12 reportedly received a frantic distress call from another patrol boat in the vicinity, PCF-19, claiming that they were being attacked by unidentified lights they were calling enemy helicopters, which seemed odd because the North Vietnamese enemy were not known to utilize combat helicopters at the time. Snyder ordered the PCF-12 to head for PCF-19's position to offer some assistance. And as they closed in, they reported spotting in the sky two circular bright lights immersed in a strange glow hovering over PCF-19's position. As they approached, one of the strange lights reportedly emitted a bright flash of light, after which PCF-19 exploded in a cascade of water and flying debris. Directly after the destruction of PCF-19, the two enigmatic lights were described as rapidly accelerating away towards the sea as PCF-12 scouted the area for any possible survivors of the carnage that they had just witnessed. Two wounded men were found and recalled that the two UFOs
had been trailing them for miles along the river. The survivors then claimed that they had decided to fire upon the threatening, mysterious objects. And that was when one of them had issued a piercing blast of light and obliterated their boat. At first, it was thought by officials that the PCF-12 had been the victim of an enemy missile fired from the shore. But a later AP dispatch from Saigon would quote a military spokesman as having attributed the loss of PCF-19 to an unidentified object and not enemy coastal batteries or missiles. The PCF-12 continued its patrol up the river and were soon approached by the same two unidentified lights, which took up positions, hovering on the port and starboard sides around 300 yards away and 100 feet above the water. PCF-12 called in to headquarters to try and get an idea of what they were dealing with, but were met with the response that there were no aircraft in the area at the time. Realizing that these craft were not friendly, Snyder ordered his men to open fire on the lights, which apparently did little to phase or even slow them down. The PCF-12 began to retreat at full speed as two mysterious aircraft tailed and stalked them, flickering in the night the whole time. Second engine man, Jim Steffes, would later claim that he got a good look at the craft and described them as having a rounded front like an observation deck and what looked like two crewmen sitting side by side. Strangely, although no weapons could be seen mounted on the unidentified aircraft, PCF-12 nevertheless found itself being fired upon. Steffes remembers seeing tracer rounds piercing up into the night from the nearby base, Point Doom, with their targets being what he said were other far-off blinking circular lights whizzing about in the sky above. Eventually, a group of Phantom F-4 fighter jets arrived to converge upon them and chase off the strange lights that were plaguing PCF-12 out to sea, leaving the crew to wonder what in the hell had just happened. While all of this was going on, there was an even stranger event taking place out in the South China Sea with an Allied ship of the Royal Australian Navy, the HMAS Hobart, which was patrolling near Tiger Island, about 20 kilometers off Cape Lay, and reported sighting up to 30 unidentified slow-moving lights hovering in the night sky near their ship, which were at first thought to be Russian-built Hind helicopters. But upon closer inspection, it could be seen that they were not. U.S. 7th 4th Air Force Phantom fighter bombers were sent to engage, supported by generous anti-aircraft fire from the ground. The lights flew out to sea as they were pursued by the fighters, which fired upon them mercilessly, along with several other military ships in the area, which unfortunately contributed to the friendly fire incident in which a U.S. Swift boat was sunk by missiles, killing 5 of the 7 crew. The HMAS Hobart was prepped for battle when the radar room detected an incoming unidentified aircraft coming in fast, with no identification number to mark it as friend or foe. Word soon came in that craft was friendly, but it was then that a missile struck the side to kill 1 and injure 2 others, followed by a barrage of 2 more missiles. Whatever the craft was, it swiftly fled the scene before it could be shot down. In the meantime, F-4 jets scrambled about firing upon the lights, joined by a hail of anti-aircraft fire from the ground, with attempts to communicate with whoever was on board the mystery craft going all unanswered. Eventually, the lights floated off, and the fighter pilots were ordered back to base. The following morning, a complete search of the area turned up not a single shred of wreckage of any enemy helicopter, or any other enemy aircraft for that matter, despite the intense fighting that had occurred. The complete and utter lack of any wreckage of any aircraft was baffling, considering that these enemies had come under such resistance and been met with so much concentrated, relentless fire. The Royal Australian Navy News would later confirm no physical evidence of helicopters destroyed has been discovered in the area of activity, nor has any extensive reconnaissance produced any evidence of an enemy helicopter operations in or near the demilitarized zone. There was little confidence among the men engaged in the incident that the aggressors had been enemy helicopters, as was at first claimed. After all, if that were the case, they should have been decimated by the potent retaliatory force displayed upon their arrival and attacks. There was also no trace whatsoever of helicopters at the time in the area before or during the incident, and no wreckage afterwards. A skipper aboard the Hobart during the baffling engagement would later claim that it was certainly not enemy helicopters, expressing his doubt of such a theory by saying, "Neither before nor after the incident was there any report by any of the ships of a helicopter being there or around Tiger Island." Now, having said that, the captain of one of the American ships told me later at Subic Bay that he thought that there were helicopters there, but the fact is, he didn't report, and if he did believe there was a helicopter, it was his duty to report it at the time, but there was no such report. American forces were certainly not the only ones apparently dealing with UFOs. In the summer of 1968, a Ranger recon unit was operating along the DMZ in an area that was referred to as the North Country in the early morning hours. The team was wary and on edge, completely attuned to their surroundings, as it had already been established that the enemy Viet Cong was positioned on the other side of the hill, so the enemy could have been anywhere, creeping about in the jungle all around them. At approximately 2 a.m., the team claimed that a bright, fluorescent blue light could be seen closing in on their position, and that the strange, unidentified object stopped to hover momentarily around a quarter of a mile away before moving towards the baffled unit once again. The entire time, the flying object was said to be completely silent. As the recon unit struggled to comprehend this bizarre sight that they were seeing, the NVA on the other side of the hill, after presumably gawking at the sight as well, did what humans do and reportedly began firing at the light in full force. The night lit up with tracer rounds blazing skyward towards the strange object floating there, and it must have been quite a haunting, mesmerizing sight. For a few moments, the object did not react, merely absorbing the assault without showing any sign of distress or damage. Indeed, it seemed to be completely unfazed by the barrage of bullets raging at it. Then, it was claimed that a blinding bright beam of light lashed forth from the object, and the NVA machine gun fire abruptly stopped, to send the jungle into a sudden silence, so profound that it was jarring. The instant quiet almost deafening in the wake of the gunfire that had exploded through the air just moments before. The light in the sky then reportedly cruised off in complete silence to leave nothing but the droning sounds of the nighttime jungle behind. The next morning, the recon team decided to make their way to the NVA camp to see what happened. Sensing that they were going to find something weird at the very least, and they would not be disappointed, they found the enemy camp to be seemingly abandoned, and strewn about were 12.7mm machine guns and other assorted firearms that looked as if they had been partially melted by a relentless, scorching heat. A closer inspection of the camp turned up what appeared to be piles of ashes and bits of what could have been charred bones scattered about. The leader of the team apparently took pictures of the scene, which he would later include in his report of the spooky incident. Shortly after, he went to rejoin his unit, but was told that he had been reassigned to another team. When he asked about what had become of his report and the photos, he was allegedly told that no such report existed, and that if he were to continue pressing the matter, he could face prison time. Other members of the team were purportedly similarly intimidated with similar threats. Another incident involving the NVA was reported in the State Journal in Lansing, Michigan on September 29, 1972, in a piece entitled, "What Was UFO Over Hanoi?" The report claimed that a huge, luminous, orange, spherical UFO had appeared at a high altitude above Hanoi on a clear day, and then hovered in a stationary position. North Vietnamese air defenses had then almost immediately fired upon it with three consecutive surface-to-air missiles, but these were either unable to reach it or unable to harm it. Although after the missiles were fired, it was reported that the UFO diminished somewhat in intensity, becoming less bright than it had been before. Nevertheless, it reportedly continued to hover over the city for a full 1 hour and 20 minutes before leaving. In a similar incident, reported by the Russian publication Aruz, another UFO was reportedly seen over Hanoi and was also fired upon by missiles, which apparently did hit it, but had no effect. In this case, the UFO is claimed to have fired a fine, needle-like, bright blue ray at the defense batteries, completely destroying them and allegedly killing around 200 personnel in the process. This particular, no doubt spectacular report has been suspected of being a hoax, but it is intriguing nonetheless. In some cases, these strange objects in the skies have apparently been attacked by both sides of the Vietnam conflict at the same time. One amazing such account was published in the News World in 1982, an article entitled Staten Island Researcher Inspired by Encounter in Vietnam War. The witness was a soldier by the name of Pete Mazzola, who was stationed in Vietnam from 1965 to 1970, and claimed that he had already seen plenty of unidentified lights in the sky during his tour, even before the frightening incident that would change his life forever and truly convince him that UFOs were real. According to Mazzola, in 1967, he had been a young soldier serving in a forward observation patrol that was tasked with radioing in the coordinates of enemy positions to U.S. Navy ships waiting in the nearby South China Sea, which would then bombard them from the water. During their mission, Mazzola's patrol found itself under attack by an enemy unit and took cover in a patch of thick, tall grass. As they were cowering there, flinching from the steady gunfire and trying to figure out what to do, they were met with the bizarre sight of several bright objects rising up into the air over the trees. He would say of this strange sight, "I couldn't believe what I saw. The other guys saw it too, but afterwards were too shocked to talk about it much, except to say, what the hell was that?" The lights proceeded to soar up over the rice paddies and palm trees, and as they did, so were suddenly attacked by incoming shells from the American ships to the south. The thunderous explosions deafening to the terrified squad on the ground. Moments later, more shells and missiles began to bombard the mysterious lights, this time from NVA positions in the north, and it seemed as if both sides of the war had momentarily forgotten about their differences to focus their booming violence on these mysterious, unearthly objects. Although shell after shell whizzed through the air towards the enigmatic lights, none of them appeared to actually meet their targets, always exploding before making contact to leave a puff of black smoke hanging in the air well short of their mark. Throughout it all, the objects were described by Mazzola as being quite calm, hovering, silently, gracefully, until around 5 minutes into the onslaught, when they apparently had enough and shot up into the sky in unison with blinding speed. Mazzola would later speculate that the UFOs had been employing some sort of device that had somehow prevented the missiles and artillery shells from reaching them. The strange incident had such a profound effect on him that the once skeptical Mazzola, who in later years became a New York City police detective, would go on to form an organization devoted to investigating the UFO phenomenon called the Scientific Bureau of Investigation. So, what was going on in and over Vietnam during the war? Would trained Navy and fighter jet personnel go to engage such mundane phenomenon? What hit the Hobart? Indeed, what attacked the PCF-12 and 19 at precisely the same time? If there were enemy helicopters involved, where was all the wreckage? Why were they never successfully shot down? And wouldn't these trained men know helicopters when they saw them? It is also strange that an enemy helicopter would so brazenly venture over the heavily defended DMZ, and it would be strange that they should fly around with their lights on all of the time for hours on end. In the case of the Hobart, it seems obvious that this was some sort of concerted attack, but by who or what remains open to debate and speculation. It is interesting that these reports make mention of enemy helicopters, as this term was used so often to describe any unidentified lights in the sky in Vietnam that it became sort of a code word for UFO. Regardless of any relation, the object had to an actual helicopter, becoming sort of a catch-all phrase for anything strange or weird in the sky. The fact that the Viet Cong were not known to use helicopters made it a perfect way to explain discreetly when men were seeing something in the sky that shouldn't be there. On October 16, 1973, the United States Air Force Chief of Staff General George S. Brown gave a press conference in Illinois where he addressed his terminology to some extent when asked about UFOs in Vietnam, saying, "I don't know whether this story has ever been told or not. They weren't called UFOs. They were called enemy helicopters. And they were only seen at night, and they were only seen in certain places. They were seen up and around the DMZ in the early summer of 1968, and this resulted in quite a little battle. And in the course of this, an Australian destroyer took a hit, and we've never found the enemy. We only found ourselves when this had all been sorted out, and this caused some shooting there, and there was no enemy at all involved, but we always reacted. Always after dark." I don't know why so many UFOs were seen during the war. I especially don't know why the UFOs felt compelled to actually attack. What I do know is that there were some truly strange things going on, and perhaps they were testing our strengths, our weaknesses, and just how hard of a fight we might put up. It reminds me of a famous quote by Arthur C. Clarke. "Two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe, or we are not. Both are equally terrifying." You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I mean, you know, there's been lots of UFO sightings, strange sightings during wartime, throughout the history of the world, you know, going as far back as the Bible. But it seems that for whatever reason, that was a really hotbed, a large amount of sightings that took place during the Vietnam conflict. And not just being, you know, observations by whatever these craft are, but actually taking place actually taking their part of the battle, like actually fighting and having these little skirmishes with soldiers, and not just American soldiers, but with the North Vietnamese armies as well. So
yeah,
very interesting. You know, I don't know. I had a, you know, one of the many reasons that I moved to the great state of Texas, but the main reason was I actually had an uncle who was, you know, of course, from New Jersey, and he became a fighter pilot. He flew like a P-51 Mustang or something in the Army back during the Great War, you know, and he was stationed in Texas, and while in Texas, he met a girl, and he got married, and they moved to Texas, which actually spawned the great, you know, what I don't know what you want to call it, the uprooting of our family and moving to Texas. So my mom and dad had come down here to visit him on just a trip, and they noticed the housing prices, how cheap it was, all the work that was down here, and so they made a decision to move down here, and then that's when I was born. But then, you know, of course, my parents talking to their parents and aunts and uncles. So after a while, everybody from New Jersey just about has moved down here. Now, we still have family in Jersey, but, you know, one of the things, the reason I'm telling all this is I remember that uncle who was the fighter pilot. He told me that while flying in his P-51 Mustang, that he actually saw some of these UFOs before. I mean, he saw them, whatever they called them, Foo Fighters or whatever. He knew several guys that saw them, and it was kind of like a, you know, not a joke, but they didn't really talk about it with their, you know, the upper levels of the military. But
it wasn't something abnormal to them either. Once you had seen it, you were kind of like, yeah, there's something up there. We don't know what it is.
Yeah, but I think at that time, you know, you're more worried about, you know, German fighter planes or Japanese fighter planes. You're not really worried about these things. They didn't seem to be doing anything, but they did see them from time to time. So that's as I got older and I read these, you know, I read all these accounts and books and I see the television shows, the documentaries, YouTube. And I have people that send emails every once in a while talking about I can't believe how gullible I am and that, you know, all this UFO stuff is all made up. And I'm like, well, that's your opinion. I have actually talked to hundreds of people now after starting the show, along with my uncle and family members, who have seen things that they can't explain. So I do think there's something going on. Now, that doesn't mean the Foo Fighters or these UFOs or whatever. That does not mean they're extraterrestrial. It could be something.
That's true.
From this planet, just something that's very top secret. Something like that. I don't know. But I like these stories. They're pretty crazy. Speaking of crazy, I'm going to ask the crazy man sitting across from me, Cam Hale. What do you think about these stories and these strange sightings in and around wars, especially the Vietnam War, where, you know, there's like a PT boat and they think that they're having a firefight with enemy helicopters, even though they know the North Vietnamese army does not have helicopters.
Yeah.
And it appeared to be like they're in a firefight with UFOs. I mean, what do you think about that?
I'm always...
How do you explain it?
You really can't. There's no way to. I'm always fascinated by these stories because it seems like... I think I've even talked about this before. I always think about the movie Predator or even Predator 2.
No, we've never talked about Predator on the show.
When they're drawn to conflict, these predators. And that's somehow it seems like... Look, I could understand if they were just checking us out, wanting to make sure maybe we didn't hurt ourselves. You know, they're not going to do anything stupid, are they? But when you're actually involved in a firefight or you get involved in a fight like that, it does, to me, it makes it seem more like it is terrestrial than it is extraterrestrial. Because why on earth would they want to, be involved with why would they even care? You know, I mean, it's, there's wars going on all the time. And half the people that live in countries that are listening to this, the countries don't care. I mean, you know, it's one of those things. So, I mean, you wouldn't go someplace and then just instantly inject yourself into a war unless it was something that was more terrestrial, I feel, something that was more here. But I don't know. It freaks me out to think about they only show up, because if they only show up when there's conflict like that heavily in those areas, and I know we see them year round, we report on it all the time, but a lot of odd, heavy sightings around conflict, I don't think I want to be friends with those people.
Yeah, it's strange that maybe they just are truly spectating.
Yeah.
Because it'd be like going somewhere and you find out that there's going to be a sword fight going down at the square. You'd probably would go down there and try to watch it too, you know?
I probably would.
See what's going on.
Probably would have to see a sword fight. That is no lie. I just wonder about the stress. Is it something that would be stress-induced? Is it something that these guys, maybe they didn't really see it, it was stress-induced from war, but then I don't know because we're not having, you know, other guys report. It's not like it's not something that happens to everybody. And also, now you talked about, let's say it's not, but the stress you're under in combat. And then imagine what it's like now you're seeing something that's a UFO and you believe it to be extraterrestrial and you're in combat with it. Mm-mm. I'm not Will Smith, bro. This isn't going to work out.
Man, that is truly terrifying. Speaking of terrifying, have you seen any scary movies recently? Are you going to? I know you go to the movies an awful lot.
I want to go see the new Planet of the Apes. You know, that movie.
Ooh, that looks scary.
It looks really good. But I'm trying to think. No, I really haven't. I started watching a new series on Amazon called Fortitude. And so far, I've really, really enjoyed it. But that's about the only thing I've really kind of dipped my toe in. But I am waiting for Game of Thrones. That one, I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's coming up, man. I need to go back and watch a couple episodes from the last season because I kind of forgot where I'm at. But that's going to be exciting. Also, folks, if you have any news you'd like to share with the show, don't forget you can email the show anytime at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. And don't forget about our sponsors. Book of the Month. If you'd like to get $10 off your first book, you have to go to bookofthemonth.com/expanded. And Dollar Shave Club. You got to go to dollarshaveclub.com/expanded. If you'd like to get more of Expanded Perspectives, don't forget we do an additional show every week on Friday called Expanded Perspectives Elite. If you want to sign up for that, you can go over to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab and sign up there. It's easy. It's through PayPal. It's $5 a month. And you'll get an additional episode every Friday, as well as access to the entire back catalog. Now, trust me, the Elite tab is on the website. We have several people that'll email the show. They're in a hurry. They went to the website on their phone, and they didn't see it. And I'm like, did you scroll all the way down? Did you scroll all through the page? Are you sure it's not there? Because I've been working here for 4 years, and I know that it's on there. But if you have any problems with your signups or anything, like, no jokes. Just email the show, and Mary will take care of you. Hope everybody has a good week. For you Elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Friday. For everybody else, stay out of trouble. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.